The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Shell. Today I'll be talking with Brian Hare, founder of Dognition.com. He's the director of the Duke Canine Cognition Center and an associate professor in both the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience and the Department of Evolutionary Anthropology at Duke University. Brian has published dozens of empirical articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and in 2007, Smithsonian Magazine named him one of the top 37 U.S. scientists under age 36. He's here to talk about his first book, The Genius of Dogs. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So it seems like there's been a bit of an explosion in dog research in the last few years. Is that the case?
Absolutely. So basically, we've learned more in the last 10 years about how the mind of the dog works, and in some cases doesn't work, than we had learned in the previous century. And really, it's because people have been using a cognitive approach, and a lot of the tools that have been developed to study human infants and primates have now been used to understand dogs better.
You say in the last 10 years we've seen that explosion. So that's not to say that there's been no dog research. Let me just go through some of this. Tell us about Rico and Chaser, because this is the most amazing thing.
Right. So in 2004, Julianne Kaminsky discovered a dog named Rico. And Julianne is a colleague of mine who worked together with me in Germany. And she basically got a phone call from a very nice lady who said, I have a dog who understands 200 words. Well, that in itself isn't that interesting, but she said something else really cool about her dog. And she says, I actually think my dog learns new words really rapidly. So Julianne was curious, went out and met the dog, and decided to play some games to test how quickly does Rico learn words. And what she found was, not only is Rico capable of learning words very rapidly, but Rico is using the principle of exclusion, or an inferential reasoning skill, to do it. And it's this exact same inference that human infants make when they first start learning words. And Chaser is another dog that basically has shown the exact same skill. So the idea is that, you know, the original finding has replicated here in America with an American dog. And it's really exciting. It's a real thing. Dogs are the only species that have been shown to learn words in a similar way as human infants.
So why do we find that so hard to believe?
If you take a traditional idea about dogs and dog intelligence, I think, you know, domestication is thought to make dogs a little less intelligent. Nobody, in terms of scientists studying animal intelligence, ever thought there was anything particularly remarkable about dog psychology. And you would expect that close relatives like bonobos or chimpanzees would be really especially equipped to learn words or understand referential communication in a way more like us than really distantly related species like a dog. So I think that's why. It was a whole slew of reasons that, holy cow, why would it be that a dog could do something more similar to a human infant than, you know, our primate relatives or our ape relatives?
Right. Well, let's talk about the research into dogs' vocal communication. I want to give people a sense of the number of things that have been studied about dogs.
I mean, one of the fun things, if you're a dog owner, to know is that it does seem like now there's some evidence that when dogs are vocalizing, it might mean something. If you're a dog owner, it can be really frustrating sometimes that, you know, your dog is just, it seems to you, barking incessantly and you don't really understand why. And actually, some scientists had concluded that when dogs bark, it's really just a sign of arousal and it doesn't really mean anything else. There's no real communicative information. But there's some really nice studies now that show that when dogs bark, they have different types of barks, that they indicate different things. For instance, that they're barking about a stranger versus they're barking about being tied up, and that other dogs can understand or discriminate those different barks. And similarly, it's the same story when dogs growl. They're growls about toys and their growls about food, and dogs can actually distinguish these different growls. And so, you know, that's kind of fun that you would think maybe they don't necessarily understand these signals, but they actually do.
Now, in one of those studies, they actually, did they use dog owners or did they use non-dog owners to test the vocal communication?
I think you're probably referring to being able to tell your dog's bark from other dogs' barks.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because in the study, they were, yes, if you could tell your dog's barks from other barks and the reason
for
that.
Those were dog owners. And, you know, that's kind of a fun one because people were pretty good at distinguishing a specific type of dog bark that their dog made, which was being able to tell if they were barking at strangers.
Well, I guess what I was wondering is, would non-dog owners be able to tell the difference?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if they could tell, like, you know, a dog that they were familiar with or unfamiliar with, but I do think they would. And the reason is there's actually a principle of animal vocalization. The idea is that basically lower pitched sounds are threats and higher pitched sounds are more affiliative. And so I think that's how, in general, different species understand the communicative intent or the vocalizations of different species. There are lots of species that understand vocalizations of other species. So that's one of the ways that animals do that. And I think humans can do that too.
So on some level, there is the sense that dogs are able to communicate naturally then with us.
Right. And it's not just their vocalizations, of course. I mean, there's also studies looking at, you know, using what human infants do is before, you know, young children can speak, they're already using their own gestures. And even simpler than that, the direction that they're looking to try to get the attention of an adult and show them things. So they may look between an adult and something they can't reach and try to point that out to them. And so we've seen dogs can do similar things. And so that's kind of fun. But all of those skills that we're talking about now, none of those are make dogs particularly remarkable. These are things that lots of different species can do. It's just nobody had ever really done the research to see whether dogs are sort of like other mammals in this regard. And it seems like they are. And so that's kind of fun.
Well, now this is everybody else's research. Your research is very interesting. You have a theory on our historical relationship with dogs in regards to domestication.
Basically, the idea is that a group of wolves at one point, and probably in various places across the world where they were interfacing with humans, a group of wolves basically said, you know what, this whole getting kicked in the face by musk ox or, you know, being trampled by elk, I mean, it's okay and everything, but why don't we just go eat the humans' garbage? And let's give up on the hunting thing. And, you know, because let's let the humans do the hunting and let's just sit around and eat their garbage. And as a result, essentially what I'm arguing is that wolves chose us. And to be able to eat our garbage, they had to be more friendly. They had to actually be attracted to humans. They had to be interested in humans. Of course, they had to be good in the beginning of, you know, not getting in trouble. So maybe they were sneaking into settlements and taking food, you know, at night. But if they were, you know, as they were able to do this, that means that they have a really reliable food source that, you know, potentially is much lower risk than what they were normally doing. And what a great solution, because the wolves that went that way, of course, they now are the most successful mammal aside from humans on the planet. Whereas, you know, the wolves that kept chasing things and hunting them down themselves, unfortunately, they haven't had a very good recent run here for the last few thousand years.
Maybe let's paraphrase this. And so your position is that dog evolution selected for what then?
Just interest in humans and
interest in.
Right, and friendliness.
This is going to be a good show. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is Brian Hare, author of the new book, The Genius of Dogs. Okay, so rather than just leave that as a baseless opinion, let's get into your research. Now, this all started with your dog, Oreo.
Yes. So what happened is that, you know, I was studying great apes and I was involved in research comparing the ability of great apes to use human gestures to understand and find where hidden food was. And the reason we were doing that was this was the same games that were being played with human infants to see how they begin to learn to communicate and then eventually participate in human culture and learn language. And the argument was that, well, if we can find chimpanzees either do or do not use human gestures like kids, it's going to tell us whether this is something that evolved during our species evolution. And the answer was, chimpanzees and even bonobos, my beloved bonobos, are not very good at using human gestures in a flexible way where they spontaneously, you can communicate to them in novel ways they've never seen before and understand it using gestures. And so I said, my advisor was explaining to me exactly what I just explained to you. And he said, you know, this is really interesting for explaining human evolution, because this is probably unique to humans that we use gestures like this and it's important for human development. And I said to him as a 19-year-old undergraduate, I said, well, I think my dog can do that. And that's how it all got started. And he said, well, wait a second, everybody thinks their dog can do calculus. And I said, no, I really do think my dog can use human my gestures. And he saw I was serious, and because he was a great scientist, he was excited about the idea. And so we went off and did a bunch of experiments, and that's, you know, how it all got started.
Well, tell us about the work with the puppies.
Well, what we found is, the punchline is, what we found is that not only was my pet dog really, really good at using human gestures really flexibly, but dogs in general were better at using human gestures than bonobos and chimpanzees. They were better than wolves, their closest relative. And the craziest part of all, as you alluded to, is 6 to 9 week old puppies, without hardly any human exposure at all, are already showing the basic skills at using human gestures. So this isn't, it seems like this is something they come prepared into life to do.
Can you explain that research? Like, how did you set up that study?
Believe it or not, that was the most fun and in some ways most difficult study to do, because puppies don't stay puppies for very long. So it was hard to run around and find them all. But once you found them, then, you know, you were attacked by puppies all the time, and it was really great. It was really, really fun. But it's very simple. You just hide food in one of two places. The puppy knows you've hidden food but doesn't know where, and then you just try to help them by telling them where it is. So you either look to where the food is or you point to where the food is. And even little puppies are able to use your pointing gesture, and subsequently other people have found they're able to use an arbitrary marker. So that means like a block that you place on top of where the food is. And this is something, you know, the great apes really can't do. They're really horrible at. And little kids are really good at, but kind of later in development than even when they start using pointing. So that was really impressive, because it's something we think is important to humans, but it's not seen in our close primate relatives, the great apes. It's not something that dogs share with wolves. So they didn't just inherit this remarkable ability from wolves. It's not something that through thousands of hours of interaction, with humans, they're acquiring. So what the heck is it? Well, the last standing hypothesis seemed to be that this is a product of domestication. But how do you test that? And, you know, science is all about falsification and coming up with a hypothesis that you can actually test and potentially falsify. But, I mean, how the heck are you going to see if dogs got essentially smarter by becoming domesticated, without domesticating dogs or something? And so we didn't really know what to do. But then just by happenstance, I learned about this amazing experiment where a group of foxes were experimentally domesticated in Siberia over a 50-year period. And they kept a control line that was not domesticated. And so I ended up on a train to Siberia.
Can you tell me about Belyaev's foxes, what he was doing?
I mean, it's actually quite remarkable. You know, in writing the book, that was one of the big things is, you know, I went to Siberia and I learned all about him. But, you know, in doing the background research on him and his family, which really nobody's ever written up in a serious way, I mean, he was absolutely amazing. And he was doing this work with the foxes at the time when Stalin had forbidden anyone doing Darwinian evolutionary studies or genetics, period. And it was a response, of course, to social Darwinism during World War II. And so during this time when it was incredibly dangerous, his brother, who was a geneticist, had been killed. You know, academics were going missing left and right into gulags. He decides, hey, you know what would be great and fun is, why don't I try to figure out this great mystery of how animals become domesticated by doing a giant evolutionary experiment. But he was clever enough to go to Siberia to do it, and he basically selected a group of foxes to be friendly towards humans. And by selecting them at 7 months, when they were sort of adolescents, he was able to just put together in and breed together over 50 years foxes that were really friendly towards people. And as a result, of course, you end up with a population of really friendly foxes. But the really cool thing that happened was those same foxes had a really high prevalence of curly tails and floppy ears and piebald coats, so coats of many colors, and at a level that was much higher than seen in the control line, that they had kept in the exact same conditions, except for they hadn't bred them to be friendly towards humans. So he knew that basically by selecting foxes to be friendly, he had basically domesticated them for all intents and purposes.
Which is exactly what you're looking for. So how did you use those foxes in your own research?
Well, I mean, what an amazing thing to have a population of animals where you actually know what the selection criteria was and that they're closely related to dogs. And the idea was, if domestication actually led dogs to have these remarkable skills at using human gestures, the foxes that are effectively domesticated, they should show similar skills as dogs. The control line should look more like wolves. And essentially, that's what we found, that the experimental foxes were really quite flexible in their use of human gestures, whereas the control lines, not so much.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back to talk more with Brian Hare, author of The Genius of Dogs, after these messages.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Brian Hare, director of the Duke Canine Cognition Center and an associate professor in both the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience and the Department of Evolutionary Anthropology at Duke University. We're talking about his book, The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. All right, so back to the foxes. You think there might be a link between how these foxes were domesticated and how dogs became domesticated?
Right, because circling back to the idea of dogs being self-domesticated, like we spoke about earlier, basically what Belyaev was able to show is that if you select foxes to become friendly, in all intents and purposes, they become domesticated. Morphologically, they show the traits of domestication, and behaviorally, they show, and even physiologically, they show all the traits of domestication. So that's a big surprise that you, just by selecting for friendliness, by accident, you cause all of these other changes in the phenotype of the animal that you're talking about. And the big surprise, also is that cognition or, the problem-solving abilities of an animal actually change by accident as well. And so that's what we were able to show. And, the idea is that probably a process very similar to what happened to the foxes happened to dogs maybe as early as 40,000, but probably somewhere between 12 and 15,000 years ago. Dogs started relying on human garbage. And because they were hanging around humans, they had to be friendly, less aggressive, interested in humans. And those wolves then bred together. And they started to change morphologically as a byproduct of that selective breeding that was occurring naturally. And then you end up with essentially proto-dogs that look different than wolves that are still competing against humans when they go out foraging and hunting. And not to mention they're, laying around at night probably barking at strangers, which is kind of a useful thing to have if you're humans and really worried about other groups raiding your group at night. I think probably people were tolerant enough to let these proto-dogs hang around, and that's where dogs come from.
Okay, so not only the research that we've discussed so far, but you've done, it seems, a tremendous amount of research that has findings in support of your argument. Which research do you find most interesting that you've done? Because there was a lot.
Truthfully, I think we've done a lot of fun stuff, and there are two things that come to mind. I mean, one of the types of research is some of my stuff, but then, you know, also other people's research is really interesting. And so, you know, one of the things that finding out this thing about self-domestication, that dogs are probably a product of their own choice of following us around, is that, well, then we start to think about, well, wait a second, if natural selection can self-domesticate a species, what about other species? There should be evidence that natural selection has done this in other places in nature.
Right.
And so that then led us to compare bonobos and chimpanzees, our two closest relatives. And bonobos have been a really hard evolutionary puzzle to understand. They're so different from chimpanzees. And I don't know, just in case people aren't aware, because people rarely talk about bonobos, sadly. But we actually have two closest relatives. It's like having two cousins in your family, and, you know, one's a boy and one's a girl. And, you know, they're equally closely related to you, but of course they're different from one another. And that's how bonobos and chimps are. They're both our closest relative. And so, you know, bonobos, because nobody really has had the opportunity to study them, nobody really understood why they were the way they were and why chimps were different from them, especially given the fact that they're so genetically close to one another. But when you look at the differences between the two species, and then you think about the differences we see between the control foxes and the experimental foxes, and that we see between dogs and wolves, wow, a lot of it starts to make sense if we think about the possibility that bonobos have been selected to be more friendly since they split with chimpanzees.
But bonobos aren't domesticated, so how does that support your argument?
Well, they're not domesticated, but they're self-domesticated. So the difference there is that, you know, domestication occurs when humans intentionally select different individuals to breed together. Self-domestication is when natural selection acts on a population and there's a behavioral and a morphological syndrome that occurs as a result because of the way that the genome is constrained to change. So when you end up selecting an animal to be friendly and less aggressive, you also have a bunch of morphological changes that happen, physiological changes as well. And when we've looked at bonobos, they have many of these changes. They fit the model really, really well. One of the things that is most relevant here is that it ends up that dogs have a much smaller cranium than wolves. So they have a smaller brain for their body size. And that's what you see between bonobos and chimpanzees. The other thing is that, and that's usually a universal sort of sign of self-domestication across different species. And the other thing that's really interesting, of course, is the bonobos are less aggressive. They're much more sexual. You know, they don't hunt at the frequency that chimpanzees do. And again, all of these are differences you see between wolves and dogs.
Okay, I'm going to bring up one more piece of research, only because I had never heard of this at all. Singing dogs, sir. I had
well,
no
okay.
idea.
There are many different breeds of dogs, many of them which we are more familiar with than others. And most of the dogs that we think of, like the American Kennel Club would have in the Westminster show, those are actually all creations of the last 150 years. You know, 150 years ago, there were no iPads, obviously. And so the equivalent of the iPad, you know, kind of the cool iPhone, iPad kind of Mac device to show off would be your purebred dog. And so people were excited 150 years ago about, ooh, that's the new, have you ever heard of this pug? Or, you know, oh, wow, you know, this is a Yorkshire Terrier or whatever. And so people got excited about all these different breeds. So all these breeds were created. But remember, we were talking about the origin of dogs at being at least 12 to 15,000 years ago.
Right. And where do we know that? How do we know that?
Through genetic studies and based on the archaeological evidence from, you know, basically archaeologists finding the remains of dogs in human burial sites, actually. But also genetic studies comparing, you know, the genomes of wolves and dogs and other species and being able to time the divergence of the two species, wolves and dogs. And the fun thing is that the fun thing is that that means that from 15 to 12,000 years ago till now, till 150 years ago, if dogs weren't all these things that we know of now, what were they? And what they were is more reminiscent of what a New Guinea singing dog is, or more reminiscent of what you might find in a village in Africa or in another developing country somewhere in the world. So New Guinea singing dogs are very closely related to dingoes. They are domesticated dogs. We know that. But they're domesticated dogs that went feral and have been feral for thousands of years. And very similar to the Australian dingo. And what that means is that while they are the product of self-domestication, they have now gone back to a wilder state. And so you can still raise a New Guinea singing dog as a puppy, and it is a wonderful pet. But in New Guinea, they do not hang out with people so much, even though it's unclear actually how they make their living, because it's so hard for people to study them now.
So much to talk about. You're tuned into Skeptically Speaking, and I'm joined by Brian Hare, director of the Duke Canine Cognition Center and author of The Genius of Dogs. Okay, I have many, many questions, sir. So first of all, just to give people an idea, how controversial is your work?
I don't know. I mean, how do you measure that? I mean, I would say that, you know, all the phenomenon that we have found, like the idea that dogs are remarkable for using human gestures, or the comparisons of dogs to wolves or dogs to puppies, those are all things that other people have independently replicated since we've discovered them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the most part, most of the findings that everybody has uncovered since have been pretty consistent. So I don't know. I think that means it's pretty solid, and it's as solid as you know, anything else that you might see in science. So, I mean, the wonderful thing about science is we could be proven wrong down the road. But for now, I'm feeling pretty good about saying that what we've found is a real phenomenon.
The studies that dispute your findings about the dog's responsiveness to human gestures, and I'm thinking specifically of one study, and it claims that wolves can be equally as good at dogs as following human gestures.
Yeah, there is a study by a group from the University of Florida, and we've responded to that finding in a response paper. And unfortunately, I think our disagreement with what they found is really quite boring, truthfully. You know, we cite the paper in the back of the book, and we don't really discuss it in the main text of the book. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because, I mean, honestly, I think the disagreement is really, really boring. And the reason is because it's essentially a statistical disagreement about how the data should be analyzed. And so if you analyze the data the way that we think it should be analyzed, actually their data is completely consistent with what everybody else has found. And so that's where, I mean, honestly, I don't think it's that controversial. I guess other people do, but
it's not so much that that's controversial, but I guess what I'm wondering is, if you were wrong about that bit, if dogs aren't better at following human gestures, would that throw your whole hypothesis out the window or not?
Oh, yeah. I think then that would be, you know, that would be really exciting if it was really true. And it would just mean that, you know, probably what we've seen is that dogs are probably have inherited this from wolves, these skills from wolves. And that's really interesting. I mean, wolves are carnivores. And in fact, I mean, we initially proposed this hypothesis.
Right.
And it made a lot of sense to us that wolves would be really good at this, because if you're chasing another species trying to, you know, catch it and eat it, it would be really good to be able to use its body language, its signals, to predict where it's going to go. And so, you know, we thought really hard about that, and a lot of people have, and I think we've done a really good job testing that hypothesis, and we haven't really found any support for it. So the, you know, I mean, I'm happy to go into as much detail as you want, but the, you know, the punchline is, I think that the arguments that people have made about, you know, that study, it misses a little bit of the nuance in the literature. And, you know, it's not just that dogs, when you point for them, that they go where you point. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated than that. We've run a whole bunch of studies to control for different explanations of that phenomenon. So it's not just the motion of your arm moving. It's not just that, dogs have slowly learned this. It's not just that dogs can only use your point. They can use lots of novel gestures. They can use arbitrary gestures. And not only that, but if you use a non-communicative gesture, they do not use that. And so all of those controls have never been run with wolves, and including that paper you're talking about. And so actually, I don't think that there is any evidence currently that wolves are doing anything remotely close to what dogs are doing. And unfortunately, that nuance always gets lost because, you know, people are obviously not, you know, necessarily reading dozens and dozens of papers to understand all the different studies and all the different conditions. Because even for me, it's hard to get my head around it.
That's why we do interviews, sir.
That's right.
So,
but I'm okay. Let me just reemphasize. I'm okay if we end up being wrong. That's fine. Because I mean, you know, I thought it was a really cool hypothesis, and at the time when we sort of rejected it because we didn't find any support for it, it was kind of like, huh, well, that would have been really cool if that was true. But it's not. I mean, we didn't find evidence for it, and so, you know, that's why we think we have the best evidence for the domestication hypothesis.
This is why I like science, sir. And the best scientists I know are almost overjoyed to be proved wrong.
Yes, that is what science is, even though it's very confusing to people, but yes, that is what it is.
So let's talk about the other things that this could be. Like, why couldn't much of the intelligence of dogs be attributed to just them being spectacular learners, which they obviously are?
Well, that's funny you say that. When you say dogs are spectacular learners, what do you mean?
Well, for example, with Chaser and Rico, why couldn't it just be them learning all those words?
Well, they certainly are learning them. Absolutely. But there are different ways to learn. So one way to learn is you have to slowly learn through trial and error, and you just basically keep continually guessing, and then occasionally you get it right, and then you slowly start sort of shaping your own behavior and forming an association over hundreds and hundreds of interactions
right. With
the world. And it's a very non-social process, and it's thought to be a pretty low-level learning mechanism. The other, you know, richer way that you can learn, and I mean richer in that it's cognitively more sophisticated, is more like what Chaser and Rico are doing, where they're actually using inferential reasoning. You can show them things they've never seen before, and they can use a principle about how the world works to solve a new problem, which is there's an object I've never seen before. I just heard a new word. I can label those things and understand what they mean. So let's go back to the associative learning of dogs. The only comparison between dogs and wolves, which was done actually before this revolutionary period in the last 10 years, it was done in the 1980s. It was a group of Malamutes were compared to a group of wolves. It's the only comparison of the two species in a completely non-social sort of Skinnerian task where you had to learn that it's the black block where you find the food, not the white block. And the dog and the wolf are by themselves in this horrible box, and they have to choose where the food is, and they never see anybody, and it's completely non-social. When you compare the two species, who learned faster? In this non-social task, do you think it's a wolf or a dog?
I would say a wolf.
So you're right. It's not that dogs actually are good at learning at all. In fact, they're quite weak. And what makes dogs remarkable is the following example. Is if you have a detour where dogs actually have to go around a fence to get food, or they have to go around a fence to find a person they really like. They're really quite horrible at it. You release them and they make mistakes. They go back and forth. They can't figure out how to get around the detour. You give a wolf the same problem. And on some of the problems, the more difficult ones, wolves learn 5 times faster than dogs. They make 10 times fewer errors, and they go, you know, very quickly around the barrier and get the target of what they're supposed to. I mean, they get their target of what they're trying to retrieve. Okay, so dogs are pretty pathetic on their own. From their own experience of successfully going around that barrier, on the next trial, they just keep making the same mistake again and again and again. What happens if they see a person on trial one go around and just go pick up whatever it is they're, you know, going to be going to get? Well, on their very first trial, they solve the problem and never make a mistake. So what it means is that dogs actually can learn faster by watching somebody else solve a problem than by actually trying to solve it themselves.
Which means it would have to be inference.
Potentially. Or a form of social learning. But regardless of what it is, the point is that when you say dogs are, it couldn't it just be learning? Well, there are different types of learning. And what makes dogs really remarkable is not the thing that you think of when you whip out your clicker and you're going to, you know, or you imagine a rat in a Skinner box. It's not that at all. That they're totally horrible. What makes them remarkable is their ability to use humans as a tool to solve problems that other species can't solve. And that's what domestication gave them.
Okay, last question. We are almost out of time, but I have so much to talk to you about. Okay, there's obviously more research to be done here. So what are you going to look at next?
Well, I think the most fun thing, of course, is that, you know, obviously we're involved in all sorts of projects, but I think the thing that's most exciting right now is we've started this new service called dognition.com. And, you know, the idea is that all the fun games that are in the book, now we've made them available to the public so you can play them with your dog at home and learn about your dog's cognitive style and how your dog, what are the types of intelligence that your dog relies on? What are the strategies they use to navigate their world? And at the same time, everybody's going to get the profit from this because, you know, questions like breed differences, we have nothing as scientists to say really about are there breed differences. And that's just because there's hundreds of breeds and it would take me thousands and thousands of dogs I would have to study to be able to tell you even about one breed difference. But if everybody plays these games through the dognition.com service, then, you know, everybody then gets to learn what are the breed differences that exist out there. And I think it's going to be a real delight for dog lovers everywhere.
Brian, thank you so much for coming.
Oh, it was so fun. Thank you.
You can find links to Brian Hare and his book, The Genius of Dogs, at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk with Virginia Hughes about canine genetics after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking one orbit outward at the little red planet that's inspired so much science and science fiction. Guest host Marie-Claire Shanahan talks to University of Tennessee geologist Linda Kay about her work as part of NASA's Mars Science Laboratory mission, analyzing the images sent back by the Curiosity rover. And she'll speak to geologist Chris Hurd, curator of the University of Alberta's meteorite collection, about using rare meteorites from Mars to study the planet's composition and atmosphere. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm Desiree Schell. I'm here with Virginia Hughes, a Brooklyn science journalist who writes mostly about the brain, genetics, and medicine for the likes of Nature, Popular Science, Slate, and other publications. Her blog, Only Human, is hosted by National Geographic magazine. Welcome to the show, Virginia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, in my interview with Brian Hare, we discussed his hypothesis about how dogs became domesticated, but that is definitely not the only idea out there. So maybe you could give us a rundown of how else it could have happened.
Well, the fun thing about research on dog domestication, at least for me, is that we really know so little about what happened. And dogs have been such a big part of our human history, and yet nobody really knows how our relationship with them got started. So there's lots of different theories about how wolves evolved into dogs. One scientist said to me that there are as many theories about it as there are researchers working on it. So one idea is that people sort of went out into the woods and deliberately trapped wolf pups with the goal of training them to be hunters or to go, track scents or to protect us. And there's been some skepticism about that theory because, researchers have tried to mimic that by raising wolf pups themselves. And apparently they've had some mixed success. I guess it can get pretty dicey when wolves, you know, after they kind of get out of their adolescence, they aren't the sweetest of creatures. So probably the most popular theory, or one of the most popular theories, is something called the scavenger hypothesis. I like to think of it as the campfire hypothesis. And the basic idea is that when humans started settling down and staying in one place instead of moving all around, they would have created waste piles that were, you know, pretty stable. And so that would have created a good, steady food source for wolves. And so the idea is that maybe some small group of wolves, maybe those that were not very aggressive, hunters on their own, or maybe they weren't too skittish, they were brave enough to hang around the human settlements. So they maybe went to the dump piles and got food there. And then the next maybe is maybe, after they got more comfortable sort of being on the outskirts of human settlements, over many, many years and many, many generations, they would have sort of been bold enough to actually go into the settlements and start, you know, looking around for food or maybe eventually begging for food. And then humans, you know, if we started slowly getting used to all these kind of mild-mannered wolves, maybe eventually we would have found them not only cute, but useful for various things like hunting or guarding and on and on and on until we get to the situation today where there's a gazillion different dog breeds that we've designed to do all kinds of things for us.
Well, why is it so hard to settle the question of how dogs became domesticated in the first place?
It comes down to the evidence. The evidence that we have is pretty spotty. So there are some fossils of dog skulls, and I think that the oldest one they found was from Siberia, and it was 33,000 years old. But that is sort of an anomaly. Most of the evidence, most fossil evidence, and most genetic evidence says that the domestication of dogs happened about 10 or 15,000 years ago, which is right around the same time that people were transitioning from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to one based on farming. But the other tricky thing is that it almost certainly happened in many places at once or kind of around the same time. There's been fossils found in the Middle East and in China. And the way that they kind of, I mean, it's hard when you're an archaeologist, I guess, and you come upon fossils, you just have to make inferences and kind of make stories that make sense, but we don't really know. So, you know, some of the strongest evidence comes from the Middle East, where they find human fossils with dog fossils, which is, you know, a pretty good indication that they were living together in the same, and, you know, otherwise wolves wouldn't be found in the same areas as people.
We do have some more recent experiments to look at about dog evolution from a genetic perspective. So could you tell us about the Axelson studies?
Sure. This is a new study that just came out in Nature about a month ago, I think. And this is this team of scientists. They're actually geneticists from Sweden. And they were trying to learn about dog domestication by comparing the genomes, so these long genetic sequences, of modern-day dogs and modern-day wolves. And they used samples from 14 different dog breeds, and they kind of merged them all together into one, quote-unquote, like, reference dog. And they used, I think, seven different countries.
Well, so now what were they looking for exactly?
So they have these really long, you know, genetic sequences for the wolf and for the dog. And the idea, the logic is that way back when, somewhere along the line, the wolf slowly evolved into a dog. And that happened by a series of very small genetic changes over time. So a lot of the modern day wolf genome and the modern day dog genome is similar because they have a fairly recent common ancestor. But in all the places that are different, those genes, whatever the function of those genes are, the idea is that they would give us clues as to how exactly the two species diverged and sort of how their biology changed.
And what did they find?
So what they found is really interesting. They found a few dozen different regions of the genome that were, you know, markedly different between dogs and wolves. But the interesting thing is that all these genes that were different, the genes are basically clumped into two categories. One category are genes related to brain development, and the other are genes related to the digestion of starches. So dogs have a bunch of genes that allow them to digest starch, and wolves don't have those genes, which makes sense because wolves only eat meat.
Well, now, what does that tell us then about how dog domestication happened?
So, caveat right away that we don't really know. This is just sort of an interpretation of, you know, these data that the researchers gave, but it seems pretty plausible to me. So, the genes related to brain development, those are interesting because dogs and a lot of their behaviors can be thought of as sort of immature or underdeveloped wolves. They're less aggressive, less skittish, like perpetual puppies. And so the idea is that maybe it's these genes, these developmental brain genes, the changes in these genes that kind of altered their brain development somehow. But the really interesting data from the study is about the starch genes. And the authors say this finding makes sense if you believe in the scavenger hypothesis. So if the idea is that wolves were hanging around all these human dump piles right when we were just beginning to get into agriculture, then a lot of these food scraps in the dump piles would have been starches, you know, grains and breads and that kind of thing. And so the wolves that were able to digest starches would have benefited most from that food source, and they would have survived, and their progeny would have survived, and they would have passed, you know, those starch genes would have been passed down over the generations.
All very plausible. I love that.
Well, I just love the idea of dogs being the wolves that mooched. I'm a very recent dog owner, and so anyone who has a dog, it just really resonated with me.
Well, actually, that's a good point. So how can we apply these study results, or can we, to present day dogs then, and to their care and feeding, as it were?
Yeah, I was totally fascinated. One scientist I talked to gave me a tidbit that I was actually really curious about, because anyone who owns a dog has probably noticed now this popular trend of the raw meat diets mm-hmm. for dogs. You go into a pet store and there are these freezers full of meat just for dogs. And it's very expensive, of course. And the idea is that, well, because wolves were carnivores exclusively, then dogs should be too, because dogs evolved from wolves. And this study says that that's sort of screwy logic, because dogs are not wolves, and dogs actually evolved to eat whatever we put in the trash. And so their digestive system is sort of set up to eat whatever we throw their way, including starches. And I want to say, though, since I don't want to cause any harm to dogs, and my vet tells me that we can't just give them everything, you know, chocolate and grapes and onions are not very good. They're very dangerous for dogs.
And you will be happy to hear that right after we're done here, we will be talking to Deborah Blum, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, about exactly why chocolate is so toxic to our canine companions.
Oh, great. Great.
Virginia, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much.
We're back with Deborah Blum, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, who writes about chemistry and culture on her Wired blog, Elemental. A Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, she's a professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Deborah, great to have you back actually interviewing with me this time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Okay, so we are going to talk about why chocolate is so dangerous for dogs, but I guess we should start with why it's so great for us, or at least why it feels so great. What is so almost magical about the chemical composition of chocolate?
Well, it's actually a fairly complicated chemistry with all kinds of interesting compounds in it that can essentially give you a lift. But there's a little caffeine in chocolate, obviously, which boosts you up. But what the compound that was particularly interesting to me is called theobromine. And it actually derives from the wonderful name of the plant, the cocoa tree, which is Theobroma cacao, which literally translates to food of the gods. And theobromine is a really interesting little chemical alkaloid. And one of the things it does for us is it's kind of a slight stimulant. And so that kind of, you know, upbeat, wired feeling that you might get from eating too much chocolate, it is sort of theobromine playing around with our nervous system.
So what does it actually do to our nervous system then?
You know, it's a kind of compound that literally sort of speed things up. It makes your heart beat a little, it literally does make your heart beat a little faster. And it's one of the reasons that people put chocolate in the aphrodisiac kind of category. You're with someone, you're eating chocolate, your heart beats a little faster. You think it's love, but it's really chemistry. It's theobromine speeding up your heart. It has actually an interesting effect on the whole vascular system and can sometimes work as a vasodilator and kind of expand blood vessels a little bit. It gives you a little bit of a nervous tingle, kind of, you know, it's a stimulant, so it kind of jingles the nervous system a little bit. You get all of those feelings, and in the way, and in a very small dose, and in the way we, in fact, very efficiently metabolize this, so it gives you the little buzz, and then we move it on, you know, it's a, frankly, an enjoyable feeling.
So there are other notable alkaloids with interesting effects, correct? The ones that fall into this category.
Well, alkaloids are really, and I love to kind of throw the name around because it sounds like kind of scary chemistry, but it's really part of the sort of everyday chemistry of plants. There's not a plant on earth that doesn't, you know, brew up a few little alkaloids to help it do its business. An alkaloid is just a scientific name for a nitrogen-based compound. And plants use nitrogen very efficiently. You know, we all know that nitrogen makes a good fertilizer for plants, but they use nitrogen very efficiently to kind of grab on to other chemicals and build these alkaloids. And if you look at, I mean, these are very different from theobromine, which is, I always think of as kind of a wussy little alkaloid. If you look at the sort of plant alkaloid world, we find morphine, for instance, is a plant alkaloid. Cocaine is a plant alkaloid. Nicotine is a plant alkaloid. Caffeine is a plant alkaloid. Some very poisonous things like strychnine are plant alkaloid. The anti-malarial compound quinine is a plant alkaloid. And so you see this wonderful witchy kind of chemistry of plants, which we use in all kinds of ways. And theobromine is a plant alkaloid. There's actually four atoms of nitrogen in that, and they tangle up with a little carbon, a little hydrogen, a little oxygen to make this very nifty stimulant.
Okay, so chocolate for humans, wonderful, check. Why is it so awful for dogs?
Yes, and I've written about this before because when you get into what I think of as the chocolate holidays, Valentine's Day, Christmas, Easter, right? I think those are probably the big chocolate holidays. You start seeing these sort of alerts from vets about the number of dogs that are going to dog emergency rooms and getting sick. And the problem for dogs is that while we very efficiently metabolize theobromine, we just break it down, get the little buzz, break it down, flush it away. The way that dogs' biology work is, in fact, they are not able to do that. And so it sits and simmers and concentrates. As they eat more chocolate, it starts sort of concentrating in their system. And I saw one study that said, for instance, for human beings, the classic theobromine buzz might be 20 minutes, but for a dog, it might be 20 hours. Right? They just get rid of it very slowly. Right. And so you have this, as you think about what it does, you have this stimulant. It speeds up the heart. It jangles the nervous system. The nerves start contracting. And now you're getting it in higher and higher levels. And then the dose makes the poison kind of sense. Theobromine concentrates for dogs. And stays there and sort of accumulates in levels that are now quite toxic. And so in a few humans who are you know, more vulnerable to some of these effects, you can actually get nasty side effects. People will get nauseated, they'll sweat, they get the trembling associated with this sort of jangling of the nervous system. They get headaches, really bad headaches. With dogs, though, you see this nervous system overstimulation can lead to convulsions. They get really not just nauseated, but really, really sick. Their heart speeds up. They go into convulsions. And if they aren't treated, if you don't give the dog something, essentially what happens is that you overstimulate the heart to the point that it simply glitches. It cannot beat any harder than it's beating. And so you end up with a heart failure situation.
Well, you mentioned dosage. So how much chocolate does it take to do damage to a dog?
You know, that's a good question. And you know, and I've seen different numbers on this. But if you look at the Merck Veterinary Manual, it will say, and this is kind of about 115 milligrams for every 2 pounds of body weight. So that translates when you start doing ounces, right? About 20 ounces of milk chocolate, about 10 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate, about 2 ounces of baking chocolate could potentially kill a 22-pound dog.
And you do mention in the post that you wrote about this that dark chocolate is worse than white chocolate.
That's exactly right, because the theobromine is more dilute in milk chocolate. It's the way it's manufactured. It's, you know, it's the dilution of the milk. You have a little bit less of that kind of concentrated alkaloid in there. So if you look at those numbers I just mentioned, you start seeing semi-sweet chocolate being twice as lethal as milk chocolate. And then when you get down to pure baking chocolate or pure dark chocolate with no messing around with diluting it with sugar or milk or, you know, some of the other things, now you're seeing a really dangerous dose. So, you know, about 2 ounces could potentially kill a dog of about 20 pounds. And this scales up, right? So larger dogs are less vulnerable, obviously. And in the dose makes the poison thing. If your dog gets into a whole bag of some kind of Valentine's Day chocolate, you've got a much worse problem than if they eat one. So if you have a dog that eats a whole bag of chocolate, they're going to get, their risk is much higher than if they just eat one piece of candy. But that would be true for us too, obviously, to a lesser degree.
Okay, so what are we saying here? That we should only have white chocolate in our house if we have a dog, or that the best way to keep your dog safe is to just eat all the chocolate in your house all the
time.
There
you go. Eat all the chocolate in your house. And keep it out of the dog's reach. I mean, what the problem, what you see with chocolate holidays, and I know it's difficult, especially if you have kids, is if the chocolate's just lying around. It's on a coffee table. It's on a kitchen counter. It's actually pretty interesting because theobromine is actually just as poisonous for cats as it is for dogs. When you look at the sort of lethal, what they'll call an LD50, a lethal dose 50%, the amount that kills 50% of a given population, it's slightly higher for cats than dogs. But cats don't have a sweet tooth, and dogs actually do. So in that sense, they're a little more like us. They love chocolate. We love chocolate. So even though it's equally dangerous for cats, you don't have the risk for cats. Dogs find it kind of irresistible. And so the idea is just, you know, be smart, know that it's dangerous, put it somewhere where your dog can't get it, and then eat it all yourself at the rate that you want to eat it, right?
Deborah, thanks very much, and wonderful to have you back.
It was absolutely a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You can find links to Deborah Blum and her Wired blog, Elemental, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're there already, maybe click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so that you can stay up to date on show news. Or you could keep clicking to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. Our guest coordinator is Rochelle Saunders. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillion is our production assistant. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.